This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Conniry. Thanks for joining us. In 2018 and part of 2019, Southwest Florida experienced a record-setting harmful algae bloom when blue-green algae, technically called cyanobacteria, choked Lake Okeechobee and the Caloosahatchee River and the canals that line it. The thick green gunk made its way all the way to meet up with a huge offshore red tide bloom that was present at the time. It was a real mess. While toxins produced by red tide are immediately perceptible to most people, you can often feel them in your throat and eyes, airborne toxins produced by cyanobacteria aren't as obvious to humans, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're not potentially dangerous. Earlier this month, we talked with a neurologist named Dr. David Davis from the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine about a paper he co-authored about research that found Alzheimer's-like brain changes in dolphins linked to cyanobacteria blooms in the Indian River Lagoon on the other coast. That area has experienced similar harmful algae blooms, particularly one in 2016. The apparent links between human exposure to cyanobacteria toxins and brain health date back to the 1980s, and in the late 1990s, an ethnobotanist named Paul Cox spent time in two villages on the Pacific island of Guam, where a huge percentage of residents were dying of a neurodegenerative disorder that's similar to Alzheimer's disease or ALS. He found links between the villagers' diet, which included large fruit bats called flying foxes, and cyanobacteria toxins that were accumulating in the seeds of cycad trees, which the foxes would eat. This led to villagers having huge amounts of the toxins in their bodies. The research on the Indian River dolphin brains is in some ways a continuation of that work back then on Guam, and Dr. Cox was a co-author on that paper. He's a renowned ethnobotanist and director of the Brain Chemistry Labs in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Today we meet him and hear some of the origin story of this research and where it's at today. He and I spoke yesterday. Dr. Cox, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you.
Great to be with you.
So we had you on the show back in 2019. Calusa Waterkeeper hosted a public health alert Florida Water Summit. You talked at it. They debuted a film called Troubled Waters. And then when I spoke to Dr. David Davis, who's a colleague of yours, on the show about a month ago, it reminded me of this whole nexus between cyanobacteria and toxins and neurodegenerative disorders. And I thought we should re-engage this issue and start by having a conversation with you. So that's sort of the groundwork of why you're here. But before we get into some of the research you did back in the late 90s and early 2000s, I want to go back to your beginning a little bit. What got you into the work that you do, ethnobotany, et cetera? What started that for you?
It's really interesting. I was trained in evolutionary biology for my master's and PhD work at Harvard University. But there was a wonderful ethnobotanist there named Richard Evan Schultes. And when he found out that I spoke Polynesian languages, he encouraged me to start doing ethnobotany. So I started sort of as really as more of a weekend sort of effort because I was in the tropics anyway. It's fascinating talking to local folks about how they use plants. But then when my mother passed away from breast cancer, I decided to change my focus to medical research using ethnobotany as a way of getting clues of where new therapies might lie.
In the 90s, you worked on HIV/AIDS, correct?
Yeah, that was really fun. I went to Samoa, to a really remote island. Barbara and I just got out a map and tried to find the largest rainforest on the most remote part of Western Polynesia. Went to Savai'i Island searching for a treatment for breast cancer, which had taken my mother's life. Turned out in their language, they didn't have a word for cancer. They had a word for lumpy breasts. I was working then with the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, and what we came up with didn't have any activity. But then National Cancer Institute Director of Natural Products, Gordon Cragg, wrote me and said, do you have anything for HIV? So we started looking very carefully at viral remedies. Healers were using a plant they called in their language mamala, Homolanthus newtons, a little tree. And lo and behold, we found out this stuff really stops AIDS, particularly using a very novel mechanism. So that became very exciting. And once that work was sort of finished and published and on its way through the glacial efforts of pharmaceutical firms, I wanted to find another sort of ailment that takes down whole families. and became very interested in this malady in Guam. Two villages had the highest known rate of a neurodegenerative disease that's Alzheimer's-like, but often it turns into an ALS-type disease or into a Parkinson's disease. So it was sort of a mystery story that I wanted to try to figure out. So I started with my team going to Guam to these little villages.
How did you come across that? Because in digging up, I found a paper you co-published with Dr. Oliver Sacks. He wrote a book about what was going on there. Did that book have anything to do with why you wound up doing that research?
Actually, I had read an article in The New Yorker. I was out in Samoa and Savai'i doing research, and there was an article published in The New Yorker magazine about this sort of mysterious disease. I started working on it and had made a number of expeditions to Guam. And Marcia Williams, wife of Robin Williams, heard about what I was doing. I knew her. She said, "Have you talked to Oliver Sacks?" I said, "Well, you know, sort of, he's a really famous guy. I'm just sort of a ho-hum ethnobotanist." And she said, she wrote him, and he wrote me, and he said, "Marcia Williams said you had something to tell me." So I went to see him in New York, told him about our research, what we'd done. He called in his assistant and said, "Hey, I think this guy's solved the Guam problem." I said, "Well, if you really believe that, would you publish with me?" So my first article in neurology was co-authored with Oliver Sacks.
Wow. Well, let's dig a little further into, like, you alluded to the fact that there were two villages there where people were getting an Alzheimer's-like, you know, brain disorder. When you first got there, like, explain how you go about starting to track down the nexus of what caused it.
Well, NIH had worked for quite a while on this, so I'm not the first person to figure out that there's an issue there. But as an ethnobotanist, I work very differently than clinicians. I don't wear a lab coat and a stethoscope and see patients in the clinic. I'm out in the villages, sitting with them, learning their culture, doing my best to learn their language. In these two villages, we visited almost every single family, the Pneumatic and Maurizio, and every single family visited had somebody who died from this disease. So the real question started suddenly coming, well, why is it these two villages? Why not other places? And why is it the Chamorros? Why not other people? You know, it's sort of like, what? Where's the murderer? What's going on here? And we knew that there were a number of toxins in the cycad flour they used for their tortillas, but the belief was there just wasn't high enough consumption of this cycad flour. But then we started putting it together, and I was thinking about this in Samoa, saw a big flight of flying foxes flying over the beach, and suddenly I thought, that's it. They're probably eating the flying foxes, and the flying foxes are eating the cycad seeds. I spoke to my colleague, Dr. Sandra Bannock, who was at California State University Fullerton then. She agreed this was worth studying, so we started an effort to go to the villages to try see what had happened. And it was really the flying foxes that helped us, because when we got flying fox tissues from the Smithsonian archival tissues and ran through a liquid chromatograph, there was this massive peak for BMAA, one of the putative neurotoxins. So we got autopsy tissue from some of the villagers that had perished. We randomized this with tissues from patients in Canada who had died of other diseases. And sure enough, it was the villagers that had high amounts of this toxin in their brains, whereas the people in Canada didn't have hardly any, except for two patients who had Alzheimer's disease. So that was a really shattering thing, because we thought we were studying a little village disease, and suddenly we had a link to a disease that afflicts millions of people around the world.
Is the disease they were getting there, I know it's not Alzheimer's or ALS or anything like that, it's a kind of a unique to that geographic location disease, but similar?
Yeah, it's called Guamanian ALS-PDC. Some of the patients, if they get it when they're younger, they get ALS-type symptoms. Others get dementia of Alzheimer's. Others get motion disorders like Parkinson's. Some poor individuals get multiple symptomologies. But what was fascinating was that these patients had neuropathology consistent with all those diseases. In other words, They have amyloid plaque and misfolded tau like Alzheimer's patients have. They have proteinopathies similar to ALS patients in their spines. And they have alpha-synucleinopathies. This is a protein alpha-synuclein that misfolds just like people with Parkinson's do. So it was sort of a Rosetta Stone in a way for neurology. And the people were so kind to us. And then, of course, with Oliver Sacks teaching me remedial neurology, and then Dr. Wilder Bradley, who was a chairman of the neurology department, the Miller School of Medicine, Miami, we made really rapid progress.
Flying foxes are fruit bats, for the listeners who don't know what we were referring to. They presumably aren't susceptible to the toxin?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they have these massive amounts, so that if you eat a single flying fox, it's the same as ingesting hundreds of kilograms of the cycad flower. But the question is, do they have some sort of resistance, or do they just lose their ability to fly and perish? And the answer is, I don't know. But it's it was really stunning to us to see the massive dose these people were getting. And to sort of put this in a more understandable scale, at its peak, 25% of the villagers in these two villages in Guam were dying of the disease. So if you've met ALS patients or people with Alzheimer's or people with severe Parkinson's, imagine that you wake up in the morning and 25% of the people around you have these diseases and are dying of it. It was really an astonishing thing. But then when we realized that this toxin, we discovered it was produced by cyanobacteria in the aerial roots of these cycad trees, this deep sort of foreboding came over us, because we realized you didn't have to be in Guam. You didn't have to eat bats to get exposed to that. You could be exposed to, you know, fishing in Lake Okeechobee. You could be, I mean, this toxin is worldwide, produced by cyanobacterial blooms.
How was the initial research received by people who were already studying things like Alzheimer's and ALS and neurodegenerative disorders?
It was really sort of almost amusing. Carlton Gattaciuszek, who had won a Nobel Prize for his work on Kuru, a sort of a similar type disease, a prion type disease in New Guinea, started writing me these letters with, they're all sort of capital letters and exclamation marks. I was touched that he'd write me. He certainly was not reticent in sharing his views. He thought that Alzheimer's had been caused by exposure to aluminum. Other established researchers are very wary. And I said to my team, our lab was in Hawaii then, I think we need a sort of a reality check. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, let's go to Stockholm. I was a member of one of the Royal Academies in Stockholm. So we went, we had a 3-hour meeting with neurologists, physiologists, ecologists, chemists. We presented our data for the first hour and then stopped, and there were no responses. Finally, I stood up and said, you know, we came here to be shot at. If we're wrong, we want to hear from our friends first. And Sebastian Conradi, a really distinguished neurologist at the Karolinska Institute, said, Paul, you need to know when your paper came out in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on this, it was the stuff of party jokes here, cocktail party jokes in Stockholm. We called it your batty hypothesis. Now we've heard the data. He said, we want to join this research. So that began our real collaborations. And in Miami, Dr. Wilder Bradley and an extraordinarily gifted neurobiologist named Dr. Deborah Mash, who was also at the Miller School of Medicine, they heard, invited me to give a grand rounds lecture there. And they said, yeah, we want in too. So suddenly I was surrounded by some of the world's most distinguished neurobiologists, neurochemists, and neurologists. And that's how I met Dr. David Davis, who was co-author with us on this most recent paper on Alzheimer's in dolphins.
I'd like to take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Dr. Paul Cox is the executive director of the Brain Chemistry Labs in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He's an ethnobotanist. Brain Chemistry Labs' mission is to discover new cures from plants. Their team includes world leaders in disciplines ranging from neurology, physiology, epidemiology, to oceanography, microbiology, and physics. Sounds like you have a lot of smart people out there. There is growing scientific evidence that toxins produced by certain kinds of algae can contribute to brain conditions like ALS and Alzheimer's, and that research stems from discoveries Dr. Cox made in the late 90s or early 2000s on the small island of Guam in the Pacific Ocean. If you'd like to engage with the show about this topic or any of our episodes, please use our social media. Just find WGCU on Instagram and Facebook. So it seems to me, if I can try to, I don't want to summarize too much, but it seems to me that the links between the toxins and brain health have been established. And so now the open question is how much chronic exposure may actually lead to effects. Is that a super distilled way to try to put it?
Well, I think that's very cogent. I mean, I really think that, you know, from Guam, our interest immediately shifted to Lake Okeechobee, which is the 800-pound gorilla here, because we knew there are cyanobacterial blooms that are frequent in Okeechobee. We know that the St. Lucie River goes to the east coast and the Caloosahatchee to the west. But when I saw on a national news program that there was such a viscous cyanobacterial bloom going down the St. Lucie River to Stewart and Indian River Lagoon, I jumped on a plane, went out there. When I got there, were 11 dead manatees out there. So this really filled us with apprehension because, you know, if, I don't know how to quite say this, but when you work in a village setting and you're there every day with people who are desperately ill, deeply impaired, grieving the loss of their loved ones, and then suddenly we see the same toxin in a metropolitan setting, it was deeply unsettling to my colleagues and to me.
But how strong is the research when it comes to the kinds of exposures humans would get from being near it versus eating bats that had bioaccumulated it, et cetera?
Well, this is where Dr. Deborah Mash from the University of Miami added so much, because she led us to a colony of vervets on St. Kitts in the Caribbean, set up by Frank Irwin at Harvard. And so we actually telescoped our best estimate of a lifetime villager dose of BMAA, the key, or at least the original toxin that we were worried about, into 140 days. And we produced exactly the same neuropathology that occurred in the villagers, all of it. So that got really scary. And then when I get to Florida on a very urgent mission, I mean, I watched on the TV and jumped on a plane, went down there. It was terrifying to think that people might be unwittingly exposed to these same neurotoxins that had triggered such a terrible malady in Guam. The real question you're asking is, you know, what's the dose? And the answer that's emerging from our research right now is it may not involve so much dose as chronicity. In other words, we studied animals that had been exposed every, you know, through their diet, just added to their diet for 140 days. The chamorros are being exposed every week. It's this, we think it's this continual bombardment with the neurotoxin through time, much more than dose, that is a risk factor for these diseases.
We haven't had a blue-green algae bloom event to the extent that we had back in 2018, but blue-green algae or cyanobacteria is everywhere. So I know the Florida Department of Health has done a better job at putting signs up since that event back in 2018, but they're still pretty ambiguous about it. You know, is there being enough to warn people about the possible risks that this presents?
When I was first at, was it Martins County? Is that the name of the county that Stewart's in?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They were really great. They put signs up around the beach, you know, do not come, don't just stay away from the water, etc. But when I got up to Lake Okeechobee, there's no warnings. And there were some local moms up there with their kids swimming and picnicking. They came up and said, why are you wearing this stuff? I was wearing hazmat stuff. I said, well, these are really dangerous toxins in the water. And they said, nobody told us. So we've tried to reach out to Florida State. We submitted briefs and white papers to the Corps of Engineers, asking them not to release cyanobacteria-laden waters down St. Lucie River and down the Caloosahatchee. And then this a Swedish documentary team produced a film called Toxic Puzzle, narrated by one of our local actors here in Jackson Hole, Harrison Ford. And that reached a lot of people in Florida. And what really thrilled me is to see not only citizen involvement, not only involvement from the emergency room physicians and the medical community, but bipartisan support now to clean up Florida's waterways. And so the solution is straightforward. Stop putting so much nitrogen and phosphorus into those waters from agricultural runoff, from sewage, and the problem take care of itself. And I think my sense, Mike, I know you're better on this, but it seems to me from a distance, being in Wyoming, that there really are a lot of people joining together in Florida now to try push clean water and clean air for the inhabitants and residents of Florida.
It is certainly one of the issues we agree upon the most here. I've been looking into L-serine. Can you explain the amino acid L-serine and how it fits into this story?
Now, this is some wonderful work done by Dr. Rachel Dunlop, one of our senior scientists in Jackson Hole in the Brain Chemistry Labs. She's an Australian. She was in Australia at the time. We wondered if there might be an amino acid in our normal proteins. There's 20 different amino acids in our proteins that is targeted by the neurotoxin BMAA. She and her colleagues in Australia did some lovely work where they found that BMAA inserts itself in neuroproteins in place of serine, causing these proteins to collapse. But she also found that if she increased L-serine in the media dish, that it stopped protein misfolding, it stopped the neurons from dying. So we're now in a phase 2 clinical trial at Houston Methodist on using L-serine to see if it might be effective against mild cognitive impairment, which is a precursor to Alzheimer's. We know from previous trials that it's safe. We don't know yet if it works, and we're going to have that solved next year. There's 100 people in the trial, and we'll find out if there's a difference between people on dose and people on placebo. It's a double-blind randomized trial.
It seems like it's fairly easy a supplement to get. I looked just in researching for this, and they're selling it on Amazon and stuff. I mean, do you take it? I don't want to put you on the spot for medical advice, but, you know, it seems like that's something that people are selling in jars of stuff on Amazon.
Yeah, well, I have to say, if it works, we don't know yet if it's going to work. I mean, if you've got a verba that's impaired, yeah, we know it works for them, but we don't know if it works for people. That'd be great because it's a very cost effective, maybe $35 a month per patient. But I think we're being overdosed in general. I don't encourage anybody to take this until we know for sure if it's efficacious. But one thing that's distressed me completely is that somebody's made deep fake videos of myself and Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN touting hokey remedies. And the Brain Chemistry Labs, we don't sell anything. I mean, we're not for profit, just trying to do our best to get to the core of these key diseases of Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, Lewy body disease, half a dozen others. And if we're right in our hypothesis, we think we can help improve the outcome for patients with all those diseases. But people are calling us up all the time now. There's a couple of patients even have come to the lab door to my house, you know, because of these hokey deep fake videos, and we're at a loss to how to get ahead of those.
I did see a CNN report with you and him. I presume they used that as the foundation for these things?
They did, and it looks like me, you know, hawking snake oil. My kids could detect it as a deep fake video, but I don't have that ability, and it's pretty distressing, I think, to prey on people who are so vulnerable, because all of us have been touched, I think, particularly by Alzheimer's disease. So I think my advice is, let's wait. We're just a few months away from knowing if it works or not. And if it does, then we'll publish it in the scientific literature and it'll be legitimate. And if it doesn't work, then, hey, we'll, you know, go back to the drawing board and try to find something new.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, I had Dr. Davis on the show and that renewed in me an interest in this. So I appreciate you doing it because I'd like to start doing more of these shows to stay on top of this research. And just in researching for today, I found all kinds of other interesting stuff you guys are doing there at the Brain Chemistry Labs, but we just don't have time today. Do you have any final thoughts before I let you go? We're pretty much out of time.
I just like to say what a gift it is to have guys like Dr. David Davis and the other wonderful scientists in Florida. Florida has an amazing scientific engine there. And my only request is that people listen a little more carefully to what they're saying, particularly the State Department of Health. And if our research shows anything, it shows that there's a tight connection between environmental health and human health. And we pollute the environment at our peril. We are so supportive of clean water, clean air for all citizens. Let's get behind the efforts to clean the air and the water of Florida.
Dr. Paul Cox is Executive Director of the Brain Chemistry Labs in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Cox.
Thank you.
You can find links to the Brain Chemistry Labs and the conversation we had with Dr. David Davis on this show earlier this month on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. If you missed any of the show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, or you can subscribe to the show as a podcast. Our show today was produced by yours truly. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Conaire. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.